distributed ledger in the humanitarian sector, and you know what the potential uses, benefits, risks, all of the above are. So I'm hoping to have a good conversation with all of you.
Thanks, Aiden. Hey, Bobby, are you on the line?
I sure am. Hi, everybody. I'm Bobby Mascara. I am the chair of the Learning Materials Working Group, and that working group supports documentation and materials for the special interest groups and other working groups. So if you need templates for use cases or white papers, I can help with that. But also, I'm very interested in social impact because over the summer, I created with a team a social impact project. So I like to hear what's going on in that ecosystem. Thanks.
Thanks, Bobby. Hi, Layla.
Hi, sorry, I was trying to get off mute. My name is Layla Yosef. I'm a research manager with Accenture, primarily focusing on blockchain in terms of helping to develop new thought leadership and supporting our client teams across a variety of blockchain projects in terms of providing research insights. I'm really interested in blockchain for good and for the development community, as I previously did global health and development work in my prior to joining Accenture.
Thanks, Layla. Mark?
Yeah, hi. Mark Ligrati, policy specialist at UN Volunteers in Bonn, Germany. I'm also a former UN volunteer. I was also in the UND Transformation Working Group on blockchain, AI and Big Data. And so that's sort of what's one of the reasons why I am the state of often in this hyperledger on social networks. So thank you.
Thanks, Mark. And also, Sean.
Hey, everyone. Sean Wilborn. I'm located in the Miami, Florida area. I'm a student at the University of Miami School of Law, going in my last year. As far as personal projects, I'm currently working on sort of the two industries that I like or am interested in is waste and water, and where I think that you know, if I could have some additional insight or if anybody has some advice, I'm working on building a waste monitoring device, as well as, and I guess from the blockchain perspective, you know, sort of bringing transparency to the waste industry. That's a little bit about me, and you know, if you want to chat more about waste or water, let me know.
Thanks, Sean. So thank you everyone for joining the call today. Before we get to Aiden's presentation, we do have some administrative things just to go through and walk through really quickly. So one of the things on the agenda is the vice chair announcement. So a couple meetings ago, we had an open call and asked that everyone express interest if they were interested in the vice chair position. And really what that is just to kind of help with facilitating some of the meetings and really driving some of like the meeting notes and some of the tasks aligned with that. So Jim Couples had reached out and expressed that he was interested in this position. And while this, you know, vice chair position is a more formal note, I do encourage that everyone in the community, and there will be other kind of leadership positions, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, to kind of reach out if you guys are interested in helping out in any kind of different aspects, and we really would appreciate any help in that regard. So Jim is not on the call today, but I'll have him join the next one and introduce himself a little bit and talk about some of his goals. So one of the other things that we're working on is what we call the work streams and projects groups. And this was kind of in line with the community survey that was taken a couple months back. And what we're really trying to do is streamline some of the focus areas for the social impact group to align with some of the things that you guys have identified through that community survey as ones that are that you view as important, pertinent, and we can build eminence as a community together for. So one of them was the, so going into this, and I think we have quite a bit of a group that have identified that they're interested in the various areas, and there are such as the white paper, you know, researching use cases and best practices and community liaison as well. And so, like Sean, you know, if you're interested in the waste management, different types of use cases, you're welcome to kind of contribute any of your findings, you know, to some of the projects, as well as, you know, identifying projects that we can all work on as a community. And also, you know, for Bobby, thank you so much for connecting us with Chris Ferris last time. And I think it was a really impactful call. So, you know, if there are more different areas that, you know, you guys as a community are interested in, I think we have a great group to reach out to and really build on those. One thing to highlight is I do think we have one project that's been identified, and that is going to be the State of Blockchain for Social Impact. The main goal of this project is going to be, let's feature different companies and their different use cases in an article, or it could be something a little bit more than that, or a blog post or something like that. We're featuring each of their companies and, you know, the products that they're using, as well as the best practice that they can share, and be able to kind of work on those and identifying where the opportunities currently are, where the state of social impact for blockchain is currently at. So if you guys are interested in helping out with this initiative, one of the things that we'll be doing is probably building out an outline for this and kind of trying to move this project going forward. So, you know, if you guys are interested, please plop your name in here. And if anyone's interested in leading this this project as well, you know, please feel free to put your name in there. Okay, so going back to the meeting agenda, the other thing that I do want to highlight is an open call for more community presentations. So we are all booked for November right now for in terms of different types of community presentations. But again, we do have many spots in December, as well as, you know, going forward in January and in February open. So if there are any like companies, projects, use cases, or, you know, technical working groups that you guys want to get connected to or are interested in seeing that, you know, feel free to either, you know, drop a note on your interest, where those interest areas are, but also if you have any connections there, you know, at any point of contact that we can reach out to facilitate that, please do let us know. So one thing, so moving forward, are there any questions, comments before we move forward? So in terms of the community updates, one of the past events this past week was actually the Yukio conference in Osaka, Japan. I don't know if Marta is on the call, but we could probably have her share some of her conference findings in the next call. In terms of some of the upcoming events, we've got the San Francisco Blockchain Week, and we actually had them present to us about the opportunity. So if you guys are in San Francisco between October 25th to the 27th, please, you know, express any interest in being a judge, coach, or a sponsor for the event. Is anyone on this call going to this event? All right. And then also,
Yeah, I was just gonna say, I mean, I had spoken with Daisy about potentially remotely from Bonn serving as a mentor in some capacity, but she still has to get back to me and finalize some of those details here in the organization as well. But anyway, I hope that all works out. So we'll see.
That would be great. And Mark, if you do end up you know, mentoring for the event, please, you know, take some time to just kind of speak with us about your experience, because we love to kind of highlight, you know, any kind of community involvement and all the different initiatives that are happening. Thanks. Thank you, Mark. So one of the other things is the Hyperledger Global Forum. This will be held in March of 2020. Highly encourage everyone on this call to attend. You guys have been a huge part of this community. So if you guys can go and we can all meet in person, that would be a wonderful opportunity. We're actually also sponsoring two workshops, one that will be led by Jim Couple, one that will be led by Lindsay, and hopefully having two different types of panel discussions and discussing different use cases and different projects within the sector. So if you guys are going, attending, interested, please do keep an eye out. We'll be highlighting this event a couple more times in the calls going forward. And one open call. So are there any other events that you guys are going to in the upcoming weeks, I would love to add them to this group list, or you can feel free to add them to yourself. So just, are there any? Layla, I think I saw you go unmuted. I don't know if there was.
I was going to say that I'm personally not, but I know there are a couple of upcoming events. I could. I was on a call this morning that some folks from Accenture were going to. So I don't know for future calls if folks who aren't on, who may be attending those, could potentially debrief. I'm happy to add what I know is upcoming in the next couple months.
That would be great, Layla. If you could, you know, add any types of events. And for our goal, you know, we're just trying to make sure we get the message. Thank you so much. That'd be great. Awesome. So I think we made it in record time. So are there any other things that you guys want to discuss before we move on to the presentation?
So I'd like to hi everyone. I'd like to learn more about this TechStars partnership in the startup weekend. So I don't know if now is the best time to understand more about that, but if you had some kind of material that we can read here, I would appreciate it.
So Andre, what we can do is connect you with the point of contact for the TechStars event, and then just have you guys can, you know, if you're interested in helping out in some way, I'm sure we can facilitate that conversation, so I can follow up with that if you're interested.
Thank you so much.
Awesome, sounds great. So without further ado, we'll have Aiden walk us through this new report that you actually developed, right?
Yeah, so thank you again all for joining. The report is built around two case studies. Yes, that's the briefer. You can download the report on that same page. And the two case studies are based on work that I've done in different capacities. So the first is on a WFP project that was run in Jordan, began actually in 2014 under the title of the Common Cash Facility, and became quickly known as Building Blocks, which some have argued was the first attempt in the humanitarian sector to use blockchain technology. Others have argued that they were using blockchain technology in that case to create digital identities. The World Food Program says that they were using it to distribute food vouchers. I think that there may be sort of a terminology issue at the heart of that debate, but it's ongoing. So I first began looking at that project when I was working as a journalist with CNN in Jordan, where it was being piloted. Then quickly became really interested in the space of, you know, social impact meets distributed ledger or blockchain technology, and began working as a consultant in the humanitarian sector. And one of the projects that I worked on was a blockchain project in Kenya with the International Red Cross. And so the second case study comes from my time with them. I'm not actually going to go too deep into the case studies on this call. There's a lot of good detail, I think, in the report, if you're curious about digging into those more. But what I thought would really be most useful with this group is for me to, you know, run through the introduction to the paper, give you kind of like 10,000 foot overview of where we were coming from when we were designing the paper, what we thought the need that it was filling was, and then go into the executive summary and talk about some of the conclusions or findings. And then I wanted to open it up for a conversation and, you know, have a discussion with all of you. I think there's some really great expertise and really wide range of experiences on this call. And so I think, you know, hopefully we can have an interesting conversation. So we began by looking not at DLT, not at distributed ledgers specifically in the humanitarian sector, but we started looking actually at just the use of digital technologies from a more historical lens in humanitarian and development assistance. And what we realized by, you know, surveying the literature was that increasingly humanitarian assistance is being delivered remotely via digitized administrative and operational systems. Often these systems come under the title of beneficiary management, which is, you know, has become kind of a catch-all in the space, by which they mean any database or any piece of software that allows them to know their beneficiary, you know, as a private sector company might come to know its customer in order to deliver a service. And so one really important function of a beneficiary management system is that it performs identification. Typically in the humanitarian sector, that means performing unique identification. In other words, determining, you know, who that someone is, who they say they are uniquely, and not just that they meet a certain you know, gradient of ID, that they are, say, a refugee according to UNHCR and the country that they're in, but that they are, you know, person X. And so I think that, you know, these beneficiary management systems are really where we began. But we also saw that in the humanitarian space, there was an increasing push to get more and more granular in terms of the information these organizations, large NGOs, had on their beneficiaries. Why? Because they wanted to enable access to services beyond the humanitarian sector. So while, you know, a Red Cross National Society may say, you know, for us, it doesn't matter if a person shows up in our database or not, we're there to deliver aid. And even if they fail the, you know, identification process, we're still going to deliver aid. A bank probably would not say that. And so the fulfillment of KYC, know your customer, and AML, or anti-money laundering criteria, becomes really important for a beneficiary when they transition to, you know, trying to access, for instance, financial services. So there was an increasing demand, or there is an increasing demand, from donors in the humanitarian space to be able to perform identification processes in a way that enables beneficiaries to build a client profile that can then be used across a number of different sectors to get access to a number of different services, many of them beyond the pale of the humanitarian organization that they're working with. Doing this, though, creates a lot of tricky problems that need to be solved, most of which, you know, have been solved for to some extent in the private sector. For instance, you know, problems around privacy and data protection. But, you know, ultimately, this is clearly a real growth area, I think, globally, across a lot of sectors, that technologies like DLT and blockchain really find themselves at the heart of debates in. And so we transitioned to looking at this move towards digitization in the humanitarian sector, you know, from the perspective of identification, because we really thought that, okay, this is at the core of what a lot of these beneficiary management systems have tried to do, and at the core of what a lot of these new, you know, emerging technology solutions in the humanitarian sector are trying to do. So what do I mean when I say identification? So we defined identification not as kind of a static action, but as a series of processes. And so we defined identification as the registration, verification, authentication, and authorization of beneficiaries. I think the most important process, arguably, in that cycle, at least for this paper, is verification. So the way that verification typically works in a humanitarian context is that a humanitarian organization like a Red Cross will make use of a breeder document, like a national ID card from a trust anchor, like a national government, to register a beneficiary. And this allows them to establish trust in their attested identity. Then later, when a beneficiary attempts to access a service, aid organizations will authenticate or perform a matching, sometimes one-to-one, sometimes one-to-n, of that identity against the identity that they have then spawned in their database. So that's how they sort of tend to prove identity, very broadly speaking, in the humanitarian sector, which is not so different from other sectors. Other systems layered on top of this identification management process can aid or you know, alter this process, particularly technologies like biometrics. So biometric, which is a biological attribute like a fingerprint or a sole print, or a behavioral trait like walking gait, can be used to establish uniqueness and facilitate verification and authentication. So we really looked at, you know, the identification process very broadly as a kind of holistic architecture. So whether it included a database layer, a biometrics layer, we were really looking for whatever was being used in the humanitarian sector to perform those functions. And I think there's a lot of different systems actually that are currently in use in the space, but a few are worth flagging, if only because they are the ones operating at most massive scale. So UNHCR, or the UN Refugee Agency, uses a system called Progress in over 70 countries. And it's actually in the midst of a transition from a local data store to a centralized cloud architecture. But currently there are 500 databases all with all data stored in the country where the beneficiaries who are recorded in the database are residing. And you know, given UNHCR's legal mandate to assign refugee status and improve the situation of refugees, it's particularly important that they have some sort of system for refugee identification. Other large systems include WFP's Scope, which currently houses the data of over 20 million aid recipients. World Vision has a system called Last Mile Mobile Solution, or LMMS, which is currently used by 20 NGOs across 29 countries. And so I think, you know, you can get a sense from just those figures of the scale at which a lot of these organizations operate and the kind of scale of this challenge. You know, it becomes particularly challenging our research revealed, and certainly as my experience as a researcher and on other projects has revealed, when you deal with populations that are particularly vulnerable, because the importance of data management, data security, and the availability of digital literacy, for instance, become much more challenging terrain to navigate. And so I think the humanitarian sector is particularly challenged in this regard because it's forced by mandate, it does operate with vulnerable populations, including groups like refugees, stateless persons, and internally displaced persons. That last group being, you know, and obviously there's deep legal definitions of each of those categories, but that last group being individuals who are displaced within their country of origin. And so humanitarian organizations, because they are dealing with these different populations, deal with a number of entangled problems, and they rarely see beneficiary management or identification as an end in and of itself. Instead, you know, they see these technologies as a way of delivering services to these vulnerable populations. And so rather than structure the report as sort of an abstract look at what identification does look like or could look like, we chose to divide it into sections based on use case. And so we looked at four pretty, I would say, predominant use cases in the humanitarian sector, predominant in the sense that they are constantly under debate and that there's a lot of interesting opinions on each of them. You know, and they are also important aid distribution mechanisms. So the first case study, the use case, I should say, that we looked at was cash transfer programming. Cash transfer programming, I think it's been estimated, accounts for something like 9% of all aid distribution globally. And it effectively means that, you know, cash is being just delivered to beneficiaries. That could be cash given out by a vendor, paper-based money given out by a vendor at a distribution point, or it could be money distributed on phones through mobile network operators. And it's that second case that we were particularly interested in for the purposes of this paper. A second case that we looked at, and we chose this one, I think, because it really is at the tip of the spear in terms of complexity in this issue, is identification provision for refugees, stateless persons, and IDPs, those particularly vulnerable groups I mentioned earlier. This is a really interesting use case because it's actually been mandated, since before the UN. When the UN was still the League of Nations, there has been a mandate. So since the 1920s, there's been a mandate to provide some form of identification documentation. That could be a travel document, passport, or just an official form of ID to these groups, particularly refugees. And since the 1920s, it's been an incredibly contentious issue, and it remains one today. And then the third case that we looked at, which again has received a lot of attention lately, is land registration and titling. As a number of economists have kind of brought to the fore of the conversation lately, there's several national contexts in which people simply don't have access to official land titles, which means that even if they have a home, even if they, quote unquote, own property, it's difficult for them to prove that in a court of law, which makes their assets highly vulnerable to seizure, and just highly vulnerable to the local power structures that they're embedded in. And then the fourth case that we looked at, which is another interesting one, is health services. The reason that we looked at this, and this is really core to the work of ID 2020, is because there's this interesting disparity between the registration of birth which is really seen as the foreground of the base layer of what happens in a national civil registration of vital statistics program is, you know, you have to register someone when they're born, and that's the all other forms of identification that they gain thereafter sort of link back to that initial record. But birth registration rates are actually quite low in a number of countries. But interestingly, what is not low in a number of in those same countries is vaccination rates. And so there's this interesting sort of opportunity, if you will, to leverage that disparity between birth registration and immunization rates to potentially use immunization programs as a way of kind of Trojan horsing identification into a citizen's life, you know, later in their development. So we examined those four use cases and we said, okay, how are each of those use cases done traditionally, you know, using legacy systems like national, you know, paper-based ID, or like the ID that a mobile network operator is spawning for a beneficiary. And then how could they be used, or how are they being changed by the use of distributed ledger technologies? And so we broke down those four different use cases, and we, you know, there's long discussions in the paper that you can all go and refer to after this if you're interested. But now I'm going to jump to the conclusions, because in the conclusion sections, we tried to generalize away from those specific use cases and sort of draw some general recommendations or conclusions out for the sector. So we noted in the conclusion that decentralized identification systems, which are just distributed, any form of digital identity system that leverages a distributed ledger, while they are purported to solve a wide range of challenges in the humanitarian sector, DLTs are still complex and emergent. And there remains significant uncertainty around how to operationalize these systems in a humanitarian context. So we looked at each of those use cases, and we ended up determining that, you know, one of the main benefits that we think a distributed ledger identification system could bring to beneficiaries, if implemented properly, would be to enable individuals to control their information at a granular level on an ongoing basis. And so the basic idea being here, if you were able to store verified claims about your identity, so attestations that you made, like I hold a Bachelor of Science from the local university, and then that attestation was verified, in that case, by the trust anchor there, which would be the university, that would then get stored in a hardware wallet, some form of repository on your local device, most probably your phone, your smartphone. Then that hardware wallet would make it possible for individuals to release minimally viable information to service providers. What we mean by that is individuals would no longer necessarily, although this is clearly a complex governance question at its heart, would no longer have to release information about their unique ID, who they uniquely are, but simply information that related to what sort of service they were trying to secure. So for instance, if you are trying to access a subsidy that was only set to be distributed to refugees, you would potentially only need to prove that you were a refugee and not that you were person X. However, while this would be a huge shift in the humanitarian sector and would require a huge shift in the way that policy and governance is currently operated, you know, one thing we spend a lot of time talking about in the paper is that the humanitarian sector, you know, the incentive structures do not necessarily lead to a situation in which interoperability is really at the heart of what organizations are trying to do. Oftentimes, it's exactly the opposite. You know, many organizations are incentivized to keep proprietary ownership of data, sometimes for security reasons, sometimes for, you know, reasons relating to their donors. We can talk about that in the discussion. But say this shift happens, the shift in control to, you know, the individual, it would also come with the creation of some liability or responsibility. And it could potentially even abrogate some degree of institutional liability to the individual or to the beneficiary, because, you know, these systems mandate that an individual be literate, by which we mean, you know, digitally literate, linguistically and numerically literate enough to manage their data, which means that, you know, in some sense, and, you know, conceivably in a legal sense, if they were to sign, for instance, consent agreements to this end, they would then be in charge of managing those relationships. So it could create liability at the individual level. At the organizational level, what is the value of a distributed ledger from an ID perspective in the humanitarian sector? So at the organizational level, you know, we think that a DLT could enable greater interoperability throughout the sector by offering access to standardized, verified identity data and program operations across a number of different organizations. Maybe more importantly, and I think this is a key point for the sector, distributed ledger tech could also enable intraoperability, by which we mean, so interoperability is an issue that often gets talked about in the humanitarian sector as a clear problem. There's organizations and they all have proprietary data sets, and oftentimes those data sets don't talk to one another. Intraoperability is another huge problem that receives way less attention. And that's when an international NGO or a national NGO leverages local partners to actually distribute programs, services on the ground. These are called community-based organizations. And so you see this sort of lack of interoperability, not only among NGOs, but also within them, within the structures and partnership structures that they use to implement programs on the ground. And so through the use of a DLT, a distributed system, we could see enhanced interoperability as well as interoperability at the organizational level. Now, you know, though those benefits are theoretically possible to the organization, these are often, and I think we've seen this in sector-wide pushes for interoperability, whether in the health sector or the public sector in other contexts, these are often more a question of political will than technical feasibility. And so this, you know, goes back to the point that we make earlier in the paper, which is that even though you can realize a lot of this technically, a lot of it comes down to, well, what are the incentives? What are the political incentives for the organizations to actually change the way that they're doing it? Why should they go over these sort of high barriers to entry, if you will, which include things like just development cost? You know, they've spent a lot of money and time and resource developing the systems that they currently use. Why should they change radically their governance structure and their technical systems to accommodate these new possibilities? You know, and I think so we close on that point, and we also close by noting that the two pilots that we talked about, so the World Food Program Project and the Red Cross Project, are both really pioneering projects in the space. There have not been a lot of pilot programs, nor has there been a lot of attention drawn to distributed ledger ID management systems in the humanitarian development sector or just public sector generally by regulatory bodies, standards, operations, norm setting groups. And so I think that we also close by acknowledging that I think we're really at the beginning of these conversations. And so, you know, a lot of these conclusions are really preliminary conclusions until the space develops further. So I will stop there. And I want to just open it up for questions or comments and have a discussion with you.
Yeah, hi. This is Mark Leroy. I was, very inspirational, and thank you for that presentation. I did have a few questions, not only on what you spoke, but more generally about ID 2020. But first, I just wanted to discuss sort of a non-humanitarian trend in the system that might have impact globally. And I just was curious on your thoughts on Facebook's Libra and Facebook obviously having a lot of pictures and an ability to then sort of match those payments against identity, and where you see that trend going, what risks are associated with that, and any other comments on that, including an alternative and sort of more in the public sphere, and how you see that emerging so that you can get to that interoperability as well. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. That's such a huge and hugely important question. Libra is such an interesting example because it really does, it would, if implemented, have, at day one, massive scale. And I think that you're right to say that this would change a lot of the kind of foundational assumptions that we use when we think about, you know, how do you do ID, not just in the humanitarian space, but you're totally right to say, you know, from a true global perspective. I think, though, that at the moment we're seeing Libra really take a lot of hits from the, you know, at the alliance level. So we've seen in recent days, and you've seen this, but there's been, there were four members that dropped out 2 days ago. And I think, you know, last week there were another couple of members that they lost. And I think that, you know, I really, just from being an observer, and I haven't been part of any of the Libra conversations directly, I think that it may be the first iteration and potentially not a very long standing one, just because of the kind of, because of how novel and new these topics are. But we may see another Libra-like entity crop up in the next 5 to 10 years when organizations are more ready for it and when they can kind of put together a more tightly knit alliance to make it happen. And then that will change dramatically how we do ID.
Great, thank you. If you don't mind, I have a follow-up question. It was more now getting into issue of privacy, not just GDPR, but thinking around you know, sort of global principles of data privacy, but then looking at you know, right to erasure, specifically right to be forgotten, and how that sort of is not always so easily managed in a blockchain system. Or it requires a certain design in the system to make sure that that is compliant. Do you have any thoughts you'd like to share on the topic?
Yeah, again, I mean, another really great question. And I think that you're, you know, also right to say that these are, that right to erasure, along with another host of rights and principles advanced by GDPR, there isn't really a clear line that any of the commissions that whose reports I've read, at least, have taken and defined, okay, what would a fit for purpose DLT system look like? How would it function technically in order to be able to operate, you know, according to our principles? I think that that question will have to be resolved in the near term, because so many of these systems are already in operation. But there's an interesting consideration in the context of the humanitarian sector, at least, which is that while a lot of these organizations will look to GDPR, and I think will continue looking to GDPR as long as it's sort of the new big regulation on the block as the gold standard in data protection. But a lot of these organizations will also claim exception to GDPR as an international organization. And so I think while they look to it as a gold standard, they also feel that they are operating outside of GDPR, especially because most of the, you know, they're not often operating in European contexts. They're mostly operating outside of the EU. And so I think that there is potential that GDPR will have less of an effect on the humanitarian sector than on others, but still, you know, it, just from a discourse level, it's been hugely significant.
But on that one part, I just wanted to note that, I'm also in the UN Privacy Policy Group, and there is the UN Principles on Personal Data Protection and Privacy that is applicable to the UN and to the organizations. The policies are, there's some time in which each agency is going to be coming up with their policies, and HDR is quite advanced. So, and they're very much linked to just global best practice. But I mean, there is some sort of symbiosis between those two.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if I could make one more point on that as well, because I think it's such an important issue, is, you know, just the existence of regulation on data privacy, especially in from a GDPR perspective, may not be enough. You know, I was having a really interesting conversation a few months ago with a representative from the NGO Access Now, you know, who was saying that GDPR is a, you know, a territorially bounded regulation. So if you're in Europe, you should be able to access its principles. But, you know, where are the groups that are actually enforcing GDPR? You know, where is the kind of civil society organization that I can go to if I'm a refugee in Europe and I want to access my, you know, right to erasure, for instance? I think the truth is that there are very few of them right now, because there's just a lack of the resource constraint. And so I think the existence of regulation is one thing, but watching the enforcement over the next couple of years will also be really telling.
This is Layla. Through your research, have you seen any sort of government-driven DLT-based identification systems, particularly sort of from the developing world, or has it largely been donor NGO-driven pilots?
Yeah, no, great question. And so I think one thing that is a commonality across a lot of the programs that we were examining is that it really is a multi-stakeholder collaboration that has to come together. And oftentimes to be able to do the work that these NGOs do in country, particularly around registration technologies, they have to have government approval. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's an official government program, but it probably means that they have some form of, you know, memorandum of understanding or some kind of cooperation agreement with the government that is enabling them or allowing them to run this program. And so I think from that perspective, actually, yes, there are, you know, several government DLT programs that are in operation. And I think we include a reference to them at the end of the paper or could shoot you some more information. But you know, most of the big national ID programs, national digital ID programs that are currently being run globally, I think there are, you know, there are very few. Mostly these programs take place on a much smaller scale.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Bobby. Thank you so much for that report. It's really fascinating, and I've already downloaded the paper. Just to say, I was at the Big Apps Blockchain Challenge, and one of the categories that they focused on for the challenge was identity for New Yorkers. So this identity, trying to get services attached to people's identity, is such a hot topic, and thus thank you for presenting it.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I'm really glad to be on and have the opportunity. The New York example is such an interesting one. I don't know, Bobby, if you're based here as well, but have you been watching the developments lately with ID NYC and the controversy around the smart chip?
No, I have not, but I would love to hear about that. I was just with the ID New York.
Yeah.
To just get all New Yorkers some kind of ID. But no, I would love to, if you can shoot me a link to that, I would really love to read up on that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a really striking example because so the program that Bobby is referencing was a program by an organization called IDNYC. So they had a citywide mandate to register, to give anyone without a form of ID some form of official ID so they could get access to a variety of services. This program, I think, was launched 3 or 4 years ago, and it came under a high degree of scrutiny because there was a FOIA request lodged by ICE around the information that IDNYC had collected in its databases, much of which included information on undocumented immigrants. And so there was a real sort of point of vulnerability, I think, that was enabled by the collection of all of this ID information. You know, fast forward until the past 2 weeks ago, IDNYC has been back in the news because they're trying to add another functionality to the smart to the card that they gave out as part of the program, which is just going through the city government and the city courts right now. So this is another really interesting sort of live example of a lot of these debates around privacy and user control, but it's actually happening in New York. And so I think it's a really powerful example to keep track of. I can definitely shoot you some more information.
Great, thank you.
Hi, this is Dre Bonifacio. Thanks so much for presenting. Heard of anything regarding, are you familiar with Real ID?
I'm not.
The initiative for Real ID in states to roll out Real ID by October 2020. I was just wondering, the issues they were having, it would appear that you know, an initiative similar to the New York ID could you know, benefit the Real ID initiative by the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So, essentially, what the Real ID is has to deal with how people travel, how people gain access to federal buildings and things. There are certain travel restrictions. If you don't have a Real ID or Real ID card, they won't let you travel, even between states.
Right.
So I was just wondering if talk about that, using DLT with Real ID as to solve some of their issues that they're having now. So.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, I'm not too familiar with Real ID in particular, but I think that it's exactly the kind of case that we were interested in looking at. From the perspective of the report, is if I understand you correctly, we will see several states implementing at the state level or at the municipal level, some version of what we're seeing already play out in New York, and the question then becomes, well, how do we make these interoperable, especially if states want to retain control over those ID systems, which, as in the case of New York NYC ID, one of the justifications for making it a New York program originally was New York is a sanctuary city. And so, presumably it has more protections. So there often is this case made for a state-based approach to ID. And I think one advantage that a DLT system could have is you could see a world in which states retained control or governance over their state-based ID while remaining interoperable with other state-based ID programs. So definitely applicable. Yeah.
Yeah, if you want to look up, it's just the Real ID Act that was enacted after the 9/11 Commission's recommendation.
Yeah.
So it essentially was just accessing federal facilities and boarding, regulated commercial aircraft and entering nuclear power plants, to name a few. But there are other use cases for it. And so I'd imagine the interoperability would, and they have this mandate. It's everybody's got to have it by October 2020. And that's, a year from now, that's not far away.
So, totally. That's fascinating. I'll definitely spend some time looking at it. Thank you for that.
Oh, yeah.
I actually had a follow-up question to, I think you mentioned that a lot of the pilots aren't really around sort of the national identity. Why do you think a lot of these, decentralized or DLT-based identification type pilots are largely in the humanitarian sector versus sort of other development projects where you do have folks in developing countries where, identifying themselves is a challenge to even access a variety of different services.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just curious, why we're seeing it more in the humanitarian sector than the development sector. Are you starting to see some of those learnings and innovations trickle through to development sector?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that's a really fascinating question. I don't know how good of an answer I have at this point, but I have spent some time thinking about it, and I think that we are beginning to see some of these technologies implemented for ID purposes, particularly for the KYC AML fulfillment use case that I mentioned, the sort of financial inclusion one. From a development perspective, there's an organization called Kiva which does microfinancing, which I think is doing something that we would class in this category of pilots, more from a development perspective. I think one of the reasons why we've seen more of it, at least, still not so much, but more of it in the humanitarian sector, is because there's a kind of pilot mentality in the humanitarian sector. This notion that, okay, there's this emerging technology, how can we use it? There's donor funds to try and test it for something, and it's, these organizations have actually stood up pilots fairly quickly. So I think that that's perhaps why we've seen more of them in the humanitarian sector. But yeah, I think we'll begin to see them in the development sector definitely in the next few years.
Right, because I think of some of these countries, obviously they don't have the legacy systems, so there's opportunity to sort of leapfrog into technology similar to like what India did with biometrics and identity. And I think Malawi's even done some biometric pilots as well with respect to health and financial inclusion, birth registration. So it's just is a unique opportunity, I think, within some of these emerging economies or developing countries to sort of pilot and test new ways of how we think about identity to address some of the challenges that, you know, they have.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that that's one of the reasons why it's so important to be having these conversations now, because you're completely right. There are cases in which, interoperability isn't so much of a backwards looking issue. It's more of a forwards looking issue, because you're not dealing with those legacy systems. In some cases, you're not even dealing with huge legacy analog systems. And so, this is definitely a key moment, I think, in the development of more decentralized ID systems.
Yeah, if I can just jump in. I mean, on that question of development, my understanding is in the UN system, the World Bank Group launched the Identification for Development agenda to address SDG target 16.9, which is supposed to give everyone free and universal legal identity by 2030. So I think they've been moving quite fast forward on the technical standards for identity. And then, speaking about the person who raised Real ID, I understand he's also the International Civil Aviation Organization, so specialized UN agency on travel documents, basically. So similarly, I think there's also a large push to see what is sort of a standard for identification, digital identification that will be accepted when people are traveling around the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it would be. Yeah, it would be a real mistake to go the whole conversation without mentioning the bank, because they are running so many digital ID programs and they are working to develop those standards. They've got a long list of technical standards and guidelines on their website about how to implement digital ID programs, which is not to say that they are, building systems that are decentralized. They're not necessarily using DLTs, but they are doing definitely relevant and hugely impactful work. I think they've got programs running in something like 35 countries right now. So it's a huge effort.
Aiden, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I think we just have about a minute remaining. Are there any final questions?
I guess for the four themes that you identified in terms of types of use cases,
yeah.
Were these, like, what was the sort of strategy behind it? Were these just the common ones? Or, because I was curious about sort of the financial inclusion piece and access to certain financial services or banking. And I don't know if that falls under cash transfer programming, but just curious as to sort of what informed your approach to kind of categorize it across these four areas.
Absolutely. So, I think that we did a discourse analysis. We looked at what the major other publications had already looked at and, what the phrases, what were the common, we did like a phrase match and we looked at what were the common phrases along with DLT or blockchain in the humanitarian sector. These were what popped up. So we just wanted to address what was being talked about most. But I would argue that, the financial inclusion piece is massive. And I think it falls between really cash transfer programming, because those programs often plug in ultimately to financial service provider, right? It's like a mobile network operator to a financial service provider. And so there is, or one that's doing both functions. So it falls there, as well as the ID, identification for these vulnerable groups. As the ID for KYC AML requirements is so central. And so we spent a lot of time thinking about it, but we didn't call it out as a category unto itself.
Great, thank you.
Great, everyone. Thank you so much for dialing in today. And Aiden, if it's all right, I will release your contact information so that people may follow up with any questions that they have.
Yeah, please. Thank you so much. This was really fascinating. Really a great question. So feel free to get in touch. And I look forward to hearing about all of your projects.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Okay. Have a good one.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.